This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and it's a pleasure to have you on our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. I'm joined in studio now by Ashley Thornburg because she and I are going to interrogate Greg Schwimm. He's a corporate comedian, and he's come to Fargo for a stand-up gig at a convention.
That's right.
Greg, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I should probably clarify the real reason I'm here. So that is the North Dakota Telephone Association annual conference, which I think the title is kind of funny just because you don't hear the word telephone that much. It's kind of like doing a show for the consortium of VCR owners.
Well, Ashley was suggesting that we just hand the phone to a couple of teenagers and see if they can operate a rotary dial.
Exactly. Yeah. That would be
not
fun, wouldn't
happen.
It? I wouldn't even have to do anything. I could just film that and sit back and go, see, here's your audience right here.
Now, this is your first time in Fargo.
It is. It is my second time, I think, in North Dakota. I had a show in Bismarck. Many years ago, it was for an electrical co-op, but first time I've ever been to Fargo.
And you did not start out as a corporate comedian. Mm-hmm. You were a television reporter in West Palm Beach. How did you go from TV reporter, which is a pretty serious business, to comedian?
Especially in Florida. Yeah, it's a pretty serious state, news-wise. Well, you know, I started doing stand-up when I was 16, and it was just a hobby. But I went to a good school. I went to Northwestern, and I thought I should use my degree. My parents certainly.
The Medill School of Journalism, no slouch there.
Exactly. Right. So I moved down to Florida and became a newspaper and then a TV reporter. But stand-up was still a hobby, and the more I did it, in the mid-'80s, the comedy club scene really started to boom, and there was places to work everywhere. And the more I performed, the more I realized I enjoyed doing it more than being a journalist. Not that I didn't like journalism. I just liked doing this better. And I thought to myself, if I'm ever going to try it, I was still single at the time, I'd better do it now. So I quit my job and I moved back to Chicago and been there ever since.
But you still write. You write a humor column for the Chicago Tribune Syndicate, right?
I do. I started doing that in 2011 and they basically let me write about whatever I'd like to write about.
And you've written a couple of books.
I have, yes. I've written my earlier one was called Text Me If You're Breathing, Observations, Frustrations, and Life Lessons from a Low-Tech Dad. And then a couple of years ago, I came out with one called The Road to Success Goes Through the Salad Bar.
Corporate comedian.
Yes.
Fairly niche market. Mm-hmm. Did you stumble into corporate comedian or did you saw that and you're like, yes, I don't want my name on a marquee. I want my name.
No, stumble is a really good word for it. I was a club comedian because I thought that's what you did. You worked comedy clubs all over the country. But I started writing a lot of material in my club act about computers. And I would have people coming up to me after shows and say, you have got to come down to my office and do that one bit, just that bit, because you just described exactly what we're going through, trying to learn a new operating system or whatever it was. And eventually – I started to get hired by corporations and businesses and so forth. And this is not something that I knew existed. I didn't know that big companies and associations had their own meetings. Again, I worked in a newsroom. We were always working. You guys are journalists. You know it never stops and you never get outside. And this was a whole new world that was opened up to me. And I remember the first time I did one of these, I did one for Hewlett-Packard. And it was down at the Dolphin Hotel in Orlando. And I remember standing on stage, and I was always having an out-of-body experience. I was thinking to myself, these are the nicest people. This is the nicest hotel I've ever stayed in, the nicest showroom I've ever worked in. These people are so sorely in need of entertainment, and I'm making them laugh. And I just sort of had an epiphany at that moment, and I thought, this is my audience.
But this is laughter with a purpose, I take it. You have to do a little research about what they want.
Yes, absolutely. You have to know your product. You have to know I don't think I could have done this without the internet because it makes it very easy to just get online, look at their website, see what they do. And my goal is not to mock them. I always say there's a fine line between having fun with an audience and belittling them. Mm-hmm. And when you start doing that, they will check out. Corporate audiences are very intelligent, and no matter what they do for a living, it is their life's work. It is their passion, and you have to remember that.
Well, some of your corporate clients here, IBM, McDonald's, United Airlines, Motorola, these are some pretty big names here.
Yeah.
What's in it for them? Why do they bring in a comedian?
I think just for a break. I think if you've ever been to one of these events, they're very serious, as they should be. They spend a lot of money. They book a big hotel. They fly everybody in. They want to train them. They want to get people excited about working for their company. But I think a big part of that is being able to show your employees that it's not all serious, that it's okay to have fun at work, to laugh at what you do. And that's really what I provide. I think I provide a little levity, a little break from all the motivational speeches and that kind of stuff. Not that those aren't necessary, but I firmly believe that everybody should be allowed to just cut loose and laugh for an hour.
Greg Schwimm is a corporate comedian. He's in Fargo for a corporate gig, and he's staying in Fargo. Where, Greg?
Well, that's an interesting point. The show that I'm doing is at the Holiday Inn in Fargo. Not open to the public, I should probably say that. But that's where I'm staying tomorrow night. But I came in a day early because I have a side project that I developed, and that is a web series that I call A Comedian Crashes Your Pad. And what I do is I stay in home sharing properties, be that Airbnbs, VRBOs, HomeAways. There's all different websites, as you know. And it's something that I started a couple of years ago. I became very fascinated with the home sharing market. And I thought to myself, anybody who opens up their house, their own accommodations to strangers, has to be a very interesting person. And really, that is what my business is about, is people.
They must like to interact with other people.
Yes, huh? Exactly. And I don't think I could do that. I don't think I could just let strangers knock on my door and stay there overnight. But there's a lot of people, obviously, because, you know, these home sharing sites are multi-billion dollar industries that do like that. And I thought, as long as I'm on the road and I have the time, if I have the time, I would tack on an extra day and find unique people. And that's really what I look for. I don't look for the most lavish property or the most expensive one. I'm looking for the quirky property, the quirky owner, the quirky host who maybe is doing home sharing for something other than just financial reasons.
So how do you search that out? Do you just read every single
description? I do. I just read profiles and I try and vet people a little bit, just like they're vetting me. Mm-hmm. That's really what I do. I'm not looking for a particular demographic. I've stayed with millennials. I've stayed with retirees. I've stayed with everybody in the middle. I've stayed with women. I've stayed with a married gay couple down in Fort Lauderdale. It doesn't really matter. It's just if I find you interesting, then I'm going to look you up.
And you've stayed in some interesting places.
Yes, I have.
I mean, I've gone online. There's some YouTube videos of Greg Schwimm, a comedian, crashes your pad, and you're actually in a van that seems to be parked where a van would be parked.
Seems That's a little right. sketch.
Little sketch, that one. That was Vail, Colorado. Yeah, I hooked up with a guy, probably late 20s, and he had one of these, an 85 VW van.
Oh, boy.
And whatever comes to mind, whatever that image that popped into your head, Doug, that's the van. And I stayed there for a night. I've stayed in a treehouse. I've stayed in an open-air tent in Colorado. I've stayed in aboard a yacht, 70-foot yacht, and everything in between, a brownstone up in Harlem in New York. And again, part of it is just these are places that I would probably never get to stay in. So why not do it and also get material out of it and have some fun? I'm having a great time doing this.
We should point out that you've got three cameras in our studio as we talk to you right now.
Yes.
Because you're gathering more material.
Of course, always.
Well, how the web series works, and I've only seen a few episodes, but you do a little bit of research into the town.
Yes.
You know, you're hiking in Arizona or what have you, and then you go into the property. Obviously, you've talked this through with the host before. They know they're going to be recorded on your phone and other gear that you have with you. And the people are, like you said, they're quirky people. And in the wrong hands, it would be really easy to make fun of some of these people, but really there is kind of an underlying humanity that is infused in the episodes, I think.
That's what I like to convey. I tell them up front, it is my goal to make you look good. I am not the star of these episodes. The people and their properties are the star. I consider myself to be the straight man. And again, if you're going to invite me into your home, if you're going to open up your home to me, what good is it for me to make fun of you? It's the same thing on – it's the same philosophy that I have on stage that I just mentioned. It doesn't do me any good to rip into you. I'm not that kind of a comedian.
And
I'm not that kind of a person.
Comedy would be not – would typically be clean and not terribly edgy.
Exactly. Now, when I interview them, if they say something funny, I'll go with it. But one thing I thought that makes my series different – I mean, you have all sorts of travel series and so forth where they just spotlight the places. My series spotlights the people because, you know, you can go to some place like Las Vegas and I don't care what you shoot. I don't care where you go. Someone's done it before. But nobody has ever done an episode where they have stayed with an ex-showgirl who abandoned her headlining career at the Stratosphere. Her name was on the marquee to go into home sharing.
Wow.
I am convinced I'm the only person that's ever done that. Now, that's a side of Las Vegas you ain't seen before.
Is she a super host? Because that's a tab I always
yes, I look at that too. I don't know if she was a super host. Personally, the property was not a super host area that I stayed at. I could see the lights of Vegas. I thought, tomorrow I'm going to be at the Rio Hotel, and I'm kind of looking forward to that.
What do you think that the hotel industry stands to learn from Airbnb? Like you said, this has turned into a multi-billion dollar mm-hmm. industry in short order.
Yeah.
There's a reason for that.
There is. And I don't think it's just price. I think people want a different experience. I have stayed in some of the nicest hotels. That's the great thing about doing corporate comedy. They take place in very nice places.
Mm-hmm.
So how many times did I say place in that last sentence? Probably way more than it should be grammatically correct. But so I've stayed in some just spectacular properties. But at the end of the day, it's still a hotel. And I think that people – I think the hotel industry can learn that people don't necessarily want to just stay in their rooms. And I think these days people don't want – you know, if you look and see what's going on in hotels, they've taken out things like the mini bars and things like that. People don't necessarily want that.
They don't want to pay $5
Well,
for
that's
Snickers.
True. We don't. Yes. But I think the hotel industry can learn that people want to get out and explore a little bit.
Now, the YouTube stuff with the Airbnb, a Comedian Crashes Your Pad, mm-hmm. the books, the online. We'll give some online addresses here in a moment. The column for the Chicago Tribune. These are all ways to keep your name out there, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. One thing, when you do what I do, I think anybody that's in show business, and I do consider what I do a form of show business, you have to have multiple irons in the fire. This web series is right now – it is just a web series. I'm looking for a buyer for it. I'm looking for a producer that can take me to the next level. I know there's a buyer out there. Mm-hmm. If I never find one, I'm having a heck of a lot of fun doing this and I will continue to do this.
What is that process? Are you pitching this to people?
I am
or
pitching
just
it, yeah. Well, a little of both. I'm hoping one of the pieces will go viral and somebody will I have pitched it to some of the home sharing sites who have not been real receptive. I don't think it's something that they necessarily aren't interested in. I think it's maybe because they didn't think of it, that maybe they're not interested in it. It didn't come from within.
Envy, huh?
Yeah, maybe. But I know someone's going to pick this up eventually.
Well, and the work that you do, it is very much your name. I mean, people go to a McDonald's here and they go to a McDonald's in Seattle and they're going to get the same food. There's a franchise there. But you are branding person.
Yeah.
It's kind of weird.
I think so. That person being me or right. That person being my host?
The person being you.
I mean,
Greg Schwemm is your brand.
Yes, it is. It is. And that is, I think all comedians, you are the brand. I mean, people always say, you know, it must be really hard to get on stage and make people laugh. That's got to be so difficult. To me, and I think most comedians will tell you this, that's the easy part. It's the rest of the day. It's the selling of yourself.
Uh-huh.
And we don't all have – everybody thinks comedians have agents and managers and publicists, and that's about one half of 1% that have that. And the rest of us are like myself who, while I do have agents and producers out there who do look for jobs for me, a lot of this I do by myself. And it's constantly keeping your name out there.
Well, our listeners can find out more about you at gregschwem.com, and Schwem is spelled S-C-H-W-E-M, as in Mother's Day. It was last Sunday.
Yes, it was.
And you've got another website, funnydadinc.com. Mm-hmm. So you've got an online presence, not just YouTube's about Airbnb, and you write greeting cards.
Well, I did. I'm not writing them anymore. But yeah, that was something that happened a few years ago. There was a company, a Seattle-based company called Compendium Cards, and they thought it would be a good idea to have a line of greeting cards that were written by comedians. And they asked about 15, and they I was honored that they asked me, and I wrote four or five. One of them, not to toot my own horn, you guys, won a Louie Award.
A Louie?
A Louie. I'm sure you know what that is.
I've forgotten.
Louis are the Oscars of the greeting card industry.
Of course. Of course.
So, I'll set my DVR.
Yes, exactly. So it was a huge red carpet celebration, yes.
Is it hard to be funny in different mediums?
It is. Well, I don't want to say hard. It's hard. It's challenging. Obviously, the column that I write for the Tribune Syndicate – the written word, you know, when I'm writing them, I have to think to myself, who's reading this? Where are they reading it? And how much explanation do I have to do for them to understand it? It's actually a really good exercise for me because my columns are 650 words. Now, that might seem like a lot. That's about 1.5 computer screens. Mm-hmm. That's 650 words. So the whole idea is take one topic and see if I can get a couple of chuckles out of it in that limited amount of time.
Well, one of your upcoming corporate event blurbs, this is for one that's in August, I think out in Phoenix, says you have a fascination with the American Girl doll company.
Yes, I do. Well,
explain.
Yes. Well, I have two daughters.
There you go.
They are 22 and 17 now, so they're a little bit out of that phase. But American Girl doll, when they were young, they were very into American Girl dolls. And I was dragged, for lack of a better
into
word,
into one of those shops?
Yes. Oh, it's not a shop. It's an experience.
Yes. Yes.
It's a lifestyle.
Bite your tongue, Doug. and it's got the price tag to go with it.
Yes, it does.
But I ended up writing a big bit about the American Girl doll company, and it really there's a business sense to it because the whole thing was that this was a company that took something that has been around for hundreds of years, in that case being dolls, and they looked at it in a new way. And that's the way I usually end my corporate shows, is talking about one of the successes is you can just look at an existing product or a methodology in a new way. And then I talk about the American Girl doll company, which I do make fun of. And I just talk about, you know, my kids going this. And I'll tell you, this bit, I've been doing it for years. It's still very timely. And I look out at the audience and I see mostly dads nodding along like, I have been through this and he is nailing it.
Greg Schwem is a corporate comedian. You can read more about him at gregschwem.com. He's in Fargo for a corporate event on Thursday. Greg, thanks for being with us on Main Street.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Coming up on Main Street, a Plainsfolk essay from Tom Ezern.
Hi, this is Bill Thomas. Prairie Public's Spring On Air member drive has been happening the last few days. As usual, there are thanks to give, mostly to you who have made a contribution. Without the support of our listeners, we would not be here at all. It's great to hear from so many people from all over our region and beyond. I'll also thank Birnbaum's Deli, the Red River Coffee Company, 20 Below, and Detroit Deli for feeding and caffeinating our volunteers and staff. The donation page is still up at prairiepublic.org, and you can still call 800-359-4145 to join up. Keep up the support. We'll keep up the programming. Thanks so much.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Tom Ezern is the writer and the voice for our weekly Plainsfolk essays on Main Street. His essays touch on bits of history unique to where we live. And today's essay by Tom is titled Sweet Dreams.
I'm going to speak about dreams. And so, of course, I have to quote the psychologist Carl Jung, who assures us that even simple people can have big dreams. A big dream, in Jung's sense, would be one vested with portent, an important dream, a visionary dream. Sometimes, sleeping deeply in the bison chair in my study, I have big dreams, but I am not ready to pronounce them important. They are big in image, drama, and sensation. These dreams have commenced since I immersed myself in research on the Dakota War in Dakota Territory during the 1860s, a conflict of destructive genesis. I have told various people about the vivid dreams that visited me following a research expedition to the Smithsonian several years ago. That venture took me to the deep vaults of the National Museum in Maryland to examine and hold artifacts collected parcel to the engagement at Whitestone Hill in 1863. The collector was Colonel Robert W. Furness, commander of the 2nd Nebraska Volunteer Cavalry. The artifacts were left on the field, I presume, by Yanktowana people. Household utensils, lances, quivers, arrows, bows, a heavy maul. A curator pulled them from a cabinet, and we examined them together, as I was able to make some identifications not noted in the Smithsonian catalog. And then she left me alone with the artifacts to study them and just hold them for hours. Some insights derived from this examination. And then the dreams, which recurred, always the same. In the dream, I'm in the vault with the artifacts when I sense that someone else is in its recesses with me, watching. And that presence is not Smithsonian staff. Well, now comes a second dream, stranger than the first. As it commences, I am somewhere on the NDSU campus in an arena-like venue, which I soon recognize as Shepherd Arena, where I recently attended a livestock show. And everywhere I look, I see Indians who do not speak to me, but obviously are there for purpose, and they appear displeased. They are no one I know personally. So I go over to the office of the president, who isn't in, but from conversation with people there, I learn of a situation. The university, it seems in my dream, holds a large and significant collection of artifacts and documents that had been collected by a medical physician who practiced at Standing Rock. For some reason, the collection is secreted in Shepherd Hall. Further in my dream, the university has entered negotiations to deed the collection to the Peabody Museum at Harvard University. So I head back over to Shepherd to get to the bottom of the situation to find out who is handling this transaction. There are still Indians all over the place. I find the guy I'm looking for somewhere in a back room, supervising the organization and packing of artifacts. I begin by asking questions, then commence haranguing him. The exchange gets heated, and I have gripped his lapels, spitting into his face, "You're not sending these artifacts to Harvard. If they're going anywhere, they're going to be repatriated to Fort Yates." Well, at close quarters, I get a good look at the guy's face, and he is, I swear, this is vivid in my dream, he is Dustin Hoffman. Somehow, Little Big Man has wormed its way through my subconscious. I am beginning to treasure these dreams. I hope they are a series. Perhaps I should be careful what I wish for.
That's Tom Ezern. He's incorporated some of his Plainsfolk essays into a book titled Pacing Dakota. Coming up on Main Street, we'll start a series of Harvest Public Media reports about pesticide safety and talk with Dickinson State music instructor Kelsey Rogers about her Badlands Opera project. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The State Health Department is proposing adding to the list of reportable medical conditions. Department Division of Disease Control Director Kirby Krueger says the list will be expanded to include a few items that are not infectious in nature.
Things like fetal alcohol syndrome, overdoses, violent deaths, things that are important public health status for us. The impacts to the public are large for these types of things. And so we want to make sure that we are getting the best data we have to make the best decisions possible on how to deal with these types of conditions that are occurring.
Kruger says this is being done to provide more data on what's happening in the state.
The better our data is, the better our decisions in terms of how do we try to impact these public health events and how do we reduce the risk to individuals in North Dakota that are being impacted by these events.
Kruger says the proposal will be taken to the State Health Council on Wednesday. He says eventually it will come to the legislature's Administrative Rules Committee. As trade relations between the U.S. and China continue to decline, American soybean farmers are caught in the lurch. Nancy Johnson is executive director of the North Dakota Soybean Growers Association. She says growers are getting a late start this spring with only about 5% of the soybean crop in the ground. Johnson says with the uncertainty of the soybean market, the question is 5% of what?
The numbers of acres kind of have gone up and down depending on whether or not it's just snowed and how far the prices just dropped. And so we think the acres are going to be down a little bit from the nearly 7 million that were planted last year. But it really will be hard to tell until about the middle of June, I guess.
It has been nearly a year since the Trump administration initially increased tariffs on Chinese goods. Johnson says it was hoped the issue would have been resolved by now, and she says the trade dispute continuing puts additional stress on farmers at an already stressful time. Johnson says the U.S. and China are not the only factors at play.
As long as the tariffs are in place, that does add a certain level of challenge because Brazil is harvesting their soybeans right now, and it is really easy for Chinese buyers to get Brazilian soybeans at a serious discount to our soybeans. So it does put us in a different position, and over time, certainly it's going to be hard to maintain the relationships if we're still at that kind of economic disadvantage.
Johnson says as field work fires up around the state, there's not a lot growers can do, but hope for the best. And what do you do with more than 300,000 filled sandbags? If you're the city of Fargo, you store them. As the spring flood threat loomed last month, Fargo estimated it would need 1 million sandbags based on reduced flood crest projections by the National Weather Service. After 4 days of production at Sandbag Central, the goal dropped to 391,000 filled bags. Some were used to shore up areas around lift stations and trap bags along the riverfront. Solid Waste Utility Director Terry Ludlum says that left a very large stockpile.
The balance of them then we have been moving out to the City of Fargo Public Safety Building, which is out north of 12th Avenue and west of 45th Street. So we think that we've probably got 250,000 or so that are stored there.
That sandbag storage area appears to be nearly the size of a football field. Another approximately 100,000 sandbags are being stored on public works property on the city's north side. Ludlum says specially engineered covers will be used to cover the sandbags, which should keep them usable for at least a year until supporting wood pallets and the bags start deteriorating. He says the city will then run the bags through a sifter to separate sand from the bags, and the sand will be used for other projects. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. North Dakota's economy is largely based on three major industries: oil and gas production, coal and electricity production, and farming. They are also among the most dangerous industries in the U.S. Today, we'll start a three-part series of reports from Harvest Public Media that explores one of the risks for farm workers: pesticides. Here's Amy Mayer.
July 28th, 2017.
Story County 911.
Yes, I have an emergency out in the field.
It was a warm morning with a very light breeze. This caller was supervising a crew in a cornfield in central Iowa.
I have workers that were detasseling, and some may have gotten sprayed by a plane.
About a dozen workers reported sore throats or headaches. Some vomited after a plane flew nearby, spraying pesticides on an adjacent soybean field. They needed to get cleaned up quickly. Cody Lawrence was working for Monsanto in a field about 20 minutes away, but he had participated in a drill for this type of emergency. So when a call came from his office telling him what had happened, he knew what to do. He hooked up a trailer like this one and headed to the workers.
It's an 800-gallon water tank. Then we have a couple water pumps and shower heads.
Monsanto, now owned by Bayer, stages these decontamination units near its seed corn fields across the Midwest. When Lawrence arrived at the site, the response was well underway.
Everybody was calm. It wasn't frantic. Like, everybody appeared to have a purpose in what they were doing.
Lawrence witnessed a textbook emergency response to a situation that never should have happened. Human contact accidents like this one, either from the air or on the ground, may be rare, but it's hard to know for sure. Harvest Public Media found there's no national database. We asked 6 states how often these types of incidents are reported and found they don't always keep track. Iowa's Pesticide Bureau Chief Gretchen Pollock says she only found out about the 2017 incident because it was on the news.
We're not a 24-hour emergency response service. If there is an emergency, we always direct people to contact emergency response. But we did get out there that day.
After a long investigation, the Iowa Department of Agriculture fined the aerial spray company $2,000. The pilot's certification to apply pesticides was suspended, and he was cited for not applying them according to the EPA's instructions on the label.
The label is the law, and all the information on that label is absolutely essential.
But is the label enough? About 28% of all pesticides nationwide are applied from the air. Some aerial applicators do more than the label requires.
So we have air tractors. The one in front of you is a 502.
Meyer Agri-Air in Wellsburg, Iowa, has written its own safety manual, which is stricter than any state or federal regulations. Company founder Joel Meyer says the concentration of most flown-on pesticides is light, about 1 soda can's worth across an area the size of a football field. He insists his pilots monitor 1 mile around the field they'll be spraying. Plus, year-round, he meets with seed corn companies and other area employers. That way, during the season, there's regular communication about where workers are in fields and when planes are flying nearby.
They know Meyer Agri-Air's rule is 1 mile. So they're pretty confident that in areas that we're flying in that we're going to obey that.
All of this communication that you're doing, there aren't regulations or rules that require you to do that. That's just the procedures that you've developed.
Voluntary procedures, yes.
Meyer's also president of the Iowa Agricultural Aviation Association, and he wants tougher safety standards.
We're hoping that by us meeting with the Iowa Seed Association, that we find a way, whether it's in the licensing or the continuing education process, that some of these measures can be put into place.
Because pilots are the last line of defense between the pesticides and field workers nearby. We just don't know how often they make mistakes. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration that looks into farm and rural issues. Next on Main Street, opera comes to Dickinson.
Northern Plains Dance of Bismarck presents Rapunzel, May 17th through the 19th at the Belle Mayhus Auditorium. A young maiden trapped in the tower begins her search for freedom as she discovers a world beyond her window. Though obstacles arise on the journey, nothing will be able to get in the way, for in the end, true love will always win. Tickets available at northernplainsdance.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Kelsey Rogers. She joins us from our Bismarck studio, and she drove down the road to get there. She's an instructor of voice and music at Dickinson State University. Thanks for joining us today, Kelsey.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you are on our air today because of something brand new in western North Dakota, the Badlands Opera Project.
That is correct.
Well, what is it?
So it is going to be an annual opera project, and we wanted to bring opera to the western portion of the state. Until Dr. Hartgreaves came to University of Mary this year, there was no opera west of Minot in the state. And so we saw a need and decided to fill it.
So who's involved in this project?
Right now, we've got a small project starting. We wanted to start small and make our mistakes with few of us. I've got myself. I will be singing. And my husband, Brent Rogers, he teaches choir at DSU, and he's also an accomplished pianist. So he's going to be our accompaniment for this opera. And then we've got actually a professor of piano who is going to be singing for us. He's an excellent tenor. His name is Joel Walters. And then we've got a guest artist coming from Minot. Her name is Gabrielle Razafinjatuvo. And she studied voice at Minot State, and I had the opportunity to hear her at a singing competition a couple years ago, and she's become part of this project as well.
And as I understand it, the opera you'll be performing on Saturday is new.
It is. It's never been performed before in public. I think it was done once as part of a workshop, but they're not allowed to release that recording because it was I think they had about 24 hours to prepare that performance. So this is the first public releasable performance of this. The librettist is actually my best friend. We met in third grade, exchanging toys on the second day of school.
Wow. And that's Chandra McClelland.
That's correct.
And who is the composer?
The composer is William Oosthuizen, and he and Chandra met in graduate school at New York University. They were taking an opera writing workshop together and got paired together to write some opera.
The opera is the fairy tale suite, Fairy Tales in Opera. Describe it for our listeners.
So it's actually two mini operas. So typically we think of opera as this sort of grandiose four-hour event with Wagner and helmets and shields. and these are much more down-to-earth, much more personable. The first one is called A Visit to Baba Yaga, and they're both in English. And A Visit to Baba Yaga is about 15 minutes long. And it's the story of a young girl who decides to skip school and the adventure that follows as she runs into Baba Yaga. You know Baba Yaga. She is a sort of Slavic myth, this witch that lives in the woods and has a house on chicken feet and a taste for small children.
Oh, that sounds a little like a nursery. I mean, a fairy tale that I've heard.
Yes.
Right? No, this is Hansel and Gretel, right?
Yes, similar to her.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what's the second mini opera?
The second mini opera is called Tin Heart, Tinsel Rose. And that one is based on the story of the steadfast tin soldier who's got one leg and he falls in love with a ballet dancer in the music box in the nursery. So we've got the soldier and the dancer and then a goblin who's kind of the unwieldy character causing mayhem.
How would you describe the staging of the pieces?
So right now we're trying for a full staging. We start our rehearsals as a full company tomorrow. And so we may have to adjust some of the staging as we go, depending on how all of this works. We need to see how we're going to work together. But right now we're planning on a fully staged production. So we've got Dr. Kenneth Haught has volunteered to build us some sets, and we've got props that we're borrowing from DSU, and it should be like a full standard opera production in the way of staging and sets.
Now, it seems from the title of the opera, the Fairy Tale Suite, and the fact that it's in English and they're somewhat brief, that you have a goal here of introducing opera to kids.
That is definitely part of it, absolutely. I taught in the public schools for a couple of years, and I have children of my own. And so one of the big discussions amongst my generation of opera singers is how to keep our art form relevant and how to engage new audiences. Because really, the history of opera is a history of rich people consuming opera. And while that certainly has a place and there's certainly been exciting performances due to very rich patrons, I really think as part of Badlands Opera Project, we believe that opera should be for everyone. And so if it's going to be for everyone, then they need to experience it. And I think children with their flexibility, they may not have heard of opera before, and so they don't have any of the sometimes biases that adults have against opera. They're more willing to come along for the journey.
And as I read it in your publicity, that students from Roosevelt and Jefferson Elementary Schools in Dickinson will be given the opportunity to interact with you and the rest of the cast.
That is correct. Yeah, we're really excited. On Thursday, we'll be visiting Roosevelt Elementary and taking some of our prop pieces with us and doing a full performance of Baba Yaga. And the kids have actually already received copies of the libretto, and they've been able to just read the libretto and discuss it with their teachers. And so they'll be ready to have some thoughts and some questions that they can share. They can talk to the cast as well as the librettist, because she'll be in town for the performances.
And how old are these kids going to be, at the whole elementary school or certain grades or what?
It's going to be mostly fourth and fifth graders. Because Baba Yaga is a little like the Hansel and Gretel witch, I thought she might be a little scary for some of the younger kids.
Sure.
My son's a fourth grader at Roosevelt, and I know that Baba Yaga isn't going to scare him. So,
well, this opera, the Fairy Tale Suite, Fairy Tales in Opera,
is presented by the Dickinson State University Heritage Foundation and the North Dakota Council on the Arts. It's Saturday evening at 7 in DSU Stickney Auditorium in May Hall, and tickets are $10 per individual or $30 for a family, and they'll be available at the door. And you're also doing a performance earlier on that Saturday at the Dickinson Public Library. Describe that.
That one I'm really quite excited about. Last year I got to meet Kim Conico, who's the director of the North Dakota Council on the Arts. And she was talking to those of us that came to the sort of meet and greet in Dickinson about her vision for the arts in North Dakota. And she really wanted to be able to increase our visibility. She said that she felt there were a lot of exciting things going on, but they no one knew about them. So that's one thing that we've been working on with this project. But also she mentioned the idea of accessible performances. And she talked about how a lot of spaces that are technically ADA compliant or the Americans with Disabilities Act compliant are still not very inviting. And I realized that in many ways described our Stickney Auditorium. It is ADA compliant, but in order to get in, you have to park at the back of the building, you have to go down a ramp and up an elevator, and that's the only way that I'm aware of that you can get direct access in besides the side door for a wheelchair. And so I thought, that's really not very inviting if I'm in a wheelchair. And I was familiar with that only because of my stroller experiences trying to get into the university, and I realized, oh, it's hard to get in here. And so I realized that at the library there's an accessible parking space right next to on the same level as their community room. I also had heard about some groups that are doing what they call accessible performances, where children or people with mental disabilities can get up and move around and make noise. And I have a nephew who's a teenager, and he has autism, and he vocalizes a lot. And so his parents normally aren't going to take him to something like an opera because you're supposed to sit still and be quiet. And that means it's difficult for them to go to classical music performances. And I realized that it would also really benefit people who are friends of mine from church that have lots of small children. You know, they have four or five little kids that can't sit still. And so I thought, if we really want opera to be for everyone, then we need to provide a space for opera to be for everyone.
Well, it sounds to me like you have a vision for the Badlands Opera for future projects.
Yes, we do.
Well, how would you describe that?
Well, first of all, I really want to get people experiencing opera. I like to compare opera to mariachi. Now, that sounds a little funny. Let me explain. I grew up in the desert Southwest, and I heard lots of mariachi blaring in people's cars, and I did not like it. Until I was a missionary in Chicago working with the Spanish-speaking community there. And I got invited to a quinceañera, which is like a sweet 16 party, and it's a big deal. And so I was at this quinceañera, and they had hired a mariachi band for the evening. And they didn't just stand in the corner and perform. They came and they surrounded each table and they would sing to them. And with a guitarist and a trumpet player and, helpfully a good-looking singer standing around singing mariachi, suddenly this was actually a really exciting, interesting art form to me. And I understood why people liked it. And I realized that when people were listening to mariachi in their cars, it wasn't so much that experience of listening to it in their car that they were thinking about. It was more of a memory of that live experience that they had. And so I realized opera is the same way. I know so many people who don't like opera, and the vast majority of them have never seen an opera live. And frankly, when I listen to an opera on the radio and I'm not familiar with it and it's in another language and I don't see the staging, it can be difficult to get into, and I'm an opera singer. And so I think that it's kind of a stretch for people to really come into understanding opera just from hearing recordings of it. Whereas if you come see a full opera production with costumes and sets, in some ways it's easier to engage in than, say, a symphony or a choir concert, although I very much love both of those things. Because there's a plot, there's a storyline, there's movement and dialogue and something to attach to. And so most people I know who've seen opera live actually really like it. And so that's part of our vision is to engage more people in opera. I think that there's so little live classical music in the Dickinson area and the surrounding region that people don't always understand the effect that it can have on them. A couple of years ago, when my husband and I first moved here, he hired an orchestra to sing with the DSU choirs this piece called the Saint-Saëns Christmas Oratorio. Now, most people had never heard of it, but because we did it in the Abbey in Richardton, the Richardton community loves to come see things at the Abbey, and so we had a full house. And I thought, how are people going to respond to this? You know, they're used to hearing Messiah, but they don't know this piece. And we finished that performance, and I think my husband interpreted it really well to make it intelligible for the audience. We also sang it in English. And when we finished, people just leapt to their feet. You could tell that it had meant something to them. And it filled this space in their heart that needed to be filled with good quality music, because that gives us a chance to sort of step out of our daily life and connect with other people and connect with great art. And I think it elevates us as a community. And I think that there's no reason that people in Dickinson aren't prepared for that experience as much as other people. I think typically opera and great music have been reserved for the elite. And I don't think that that's a necessary component of what we do. I think that what we do should be for everyone.
Well, it sounds to me like the Badlands Opera Project, which will be an annual event, has its goal of bringing an art form to people that haven't necessarily been running toward it. So will the next piece also be in English? Will the next piece be a new work? How would you describe the sort of the process of deciding what to do?
Well, our original goal for this year was to do The Old Maid and the Thief, and actually to put it on radio because it was written for radio.
Ah.
However, the process of getting rights, because that opera was written by Giancarlo Minotti, and his work is not in the public domain, unlike most of opera, which is. And so I spent about 6 months trying to pin down who actually held the rights. And when I finally pinned them down, they weren't going to be able to give me an answer till about the beginning or middle of March. And that didn't seem like enough time. So we had to pick it's something else. And so ultimately, we would like to do that. Minotti's works are very accessible. They tend to be about an hour. They're written in English. They have very fun, lovable characters. So definitely, we're looking at that. I think Gilbert and Sullivan is going to be on our docket.
Little Pirates of Penzance.
Yes, that's definitely one coming down the road for us, I think. The next 2 years, we're going to be doing less involved productions because I'm actually going to be living in Fargo during the week getting a doctorate at NDSU.
Welcome.
thank you. That's we're going to pare back what we're doing the next couple of years and probably just do some gala evenings with arias. Once I'm done with that, we'll definitely be looking at a lot of aria operas in English. Although I'm hoping we'll do some of the more traditional repertoire, some Verdi and Strauss. Well, maybe not Verdi, but Strauss and Rossini, but perhaps in English translations.
Now, you sing in the upcoming performance. You're a soprano. So
yes.
How long have you been working on this?
The music?
Yes.
We've been working on the music. We got this all finalized, what we were doing in January. So we've been working on learning this piece since about that time.
And did you get involved in the project because you started it?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
I am also the founder of the project.
And you are also involved in other things.
Yes.
You're the executive secretary of the North Dakota chapter of the National Association of Teachers of Singing.
That is correct.
I guess you'd call that NATS.
Yes, we do call it NATS, but, you know, it always makes me think of very small flies.
I hear you. It's that time of year, too. And you're the artistic director of If Music Be the Food. What
yes.
is that?
So that is one of my favorite things that we do. It is a benefit recital series. And a benefit recital is one where no one pays the performers. We all contribute our talents. And then the proceeds all go to the Amen Food Pantry in Dickinson. So people can bring food or they bring donations for the food pantry. But also we really encourage people just to come even if they can't afford to donate, even if there's someone that might be a patron at the food pantry, because it's a gift of music to our community. And that's been really wonderful. We've had lots of colleagues from the Dickinson State Music Department as well as other music professionals in the community participate. And I've loved that. We've been able to help the pantry several times, and we do that twice a year.
Kelsey Rogers is an instructor of voice and music at Dickinson State University, and she'll be performing on Saturday evening at Dickinson State's Stickney Auditorium in May Hall at 7 p.m. The Fairy Tale Suite, Fairy Tales in Opera, will perform its inaugural presentation in Dickinson. The tickets are $10 per individual, $30 per family, and they'll be available at the door. Kelsey, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Decoded 8 Book is next.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Decoded 8 Book for May 14th. North Dakota remembers Theodore Roosevelt in the 100th year since his death, featuring the words of Roosevelt as performed by Steve Stark. Theodore Roosevelt created the first national park in North Dakota. It was just weeks old on this date in 1904, one of five national parks added by Roosevelt. The relatively small 780 wooded acres near Devil's Lake suffered a rough start in size, funding, and management. Roosevelt never visited the park, named for a controversial Civil War general who brutally fought the Lakota and Dakota in 1864. In 1931, the National Park designation was rescinded, the park becoming a game refuge under the aegis of the National Wildlife Refuge System. Today, Sully's Hill National Game Preserve has expanded to over 1,600 acres of prairie and woodland as a fascinating and picturesque home to a controlled number of bison and elk, a large herd of roaming deer, and a steady, impressive array of migratory birds. Both the car route and the two-mile, mostly wooded hiking trail offer a beautiful trek. Those daring to make the steep climb up the actual Sully's Hill are treated to one of the state's remarkable views of a memorable nature preserve that Theodore Roosevelt believed in with his every fiber.
It will be a real misfortune if our wild animals disappear from mountain, plain, and forest to be found only in game preserves. It is to the interest of all of us to see that there is ample and real protection for our game as for our woodlands. A true democracy, really alive to its opportunities, will insist upon such game preservation, for it is to the interest of our people as a whole. Conservation and rural life policies are really two sides to the same policy, and at bottom lies the fundamental law that neither man nor nature can prosper unless, in dealing with the present, thought is steadily given to the future.
Today's Decoded 8 Book was written and performed by Steve Stark. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Decoded 8 Book is produced in cooperation with the Historical Society of North Dakota. This series with funding from the Theodore Roosevelt Medora Foundation.
Wednesday on Main Street, horticulturist Ron Smith will join us on the air to take your calls and emails. He'll share advice on weed control in lawns, planting winter-tolerant plants, and sowing vegetable seeds. It's that time of year, so send in your email questions to mainstreet@prairiepublic.org. And we'll have part two of Harvest Public Media's report on farm workers exposed to ag chemicals. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.